At about this time, every election cycle, we begin to hear people come out and say, you know, I'm going to run from president, I'm going to run for governor or senator or whatever the elected position may be. And not shortly after, or just very shortly thereafter, there will be people that will scrutinize their lives. And there may be some huge revelation that comes to light and disqualifies that person from candidacy because of what they learned. We call those skeletons in our closets. And there are people, there's no perfect people, there are none. But there are some who have some skeletons in their closet that are so significant that if it were to ever see the light of day, it would destroy their influence and their electability would be just shot. Well, with reference to God, there are some who would tell you that God has some skeletons in his closets. And those skeletons are reason that you should have nothing to do with him at all. And I want to look at three of those alleged skeletons tonight. It's just really a period of study, a period of thought, to give some attention to a few things that sometimes we have to run into. Now, I will say that there are skeletons in the closets of some deities. And in fact, if you have your Bible, go ahead and open it to Jeremiah chapter 10. I want to read the first 10 verses there with you as we look at this, because There's a deep, dark, hidden secret about these pagan gods and pagan deities that nobody needs to know about. If you know these things, it should shake your faith in them and cause you to turn away from them. And Jeremiah reveals it to us. So here's what he says. Hear the word of the Lord. Or hear the word which the Lord speaks to you, O house of Israel. Thus says the Lord, do not learn the way of the Gentiles. Do not be dismayed at the signs of heaven, for the Gentiles are dismayed at them, for the customs of the peoples are futile. For one cuts a tree from the forest, the work of the hands of the workmen with an axe, they decorate it with silver and gold. They fasten it with nails and hammers so that it won't topple. They're upright like a palm tree. They cannot speak. They must be carried because they cannot go by themselves. Do not be afraid of them, for they cannot do evil, nor can they do any good. Inasmuch as there is none like you, O Lord, you are great and your name is great in might. Now, just to give you the background, here's what he's saying. He's saying, let me tell you a little secret, a skeleton in the closet of those who worship these false gods. Did you know that these people who worship these false deities, do you know that they've got to go out in the woods and cut down a tree, and then they take that tree and they strip it of its branches to where you have basically kind of like a totem pole, and then they carve an image in that, and then they bring it into their house and they set it up so that it can be, you know, there to worship. But, you know, they even have to build a base, you know, like you have 1x4s or something in a cross. You know, they would set that up, make a base for it so it won't topple over. And they hang gold on it. And, it never speaks. And if it's to move itself from one end of the house to the other, they're going to have to pick it up and move it and carry it. It doesn't even have strength to move itself. That's the secret that they're not telling you. That's the skeleton in the closet of pagan deities. They're handmade by men. It's man that makes them. It's man that carries them here and there. They have no power of their own. And so the Lord says, don't be afraid of them. They can't hurt you and they can't do any good for you. But as for the Lord, he has great might. Continue reading with me, verse 7. Who would not fear you, O King of the nations? For this is your rightful due. For among all the wise men of the nations and all of their kingdoms, there is none like you. But they're altogether dull-hearted and foolish. A wooden idol is worthless doctrine. Silver is beaten into plates, and it's brought from Tarshish, and gold from Uphaz, the work of craftsmen, and the hands of the metalsmith. Blue and purple are the clothing. They are all the work of skillful men. But the Lord is the true God. He's the living God and the everlasting King. At His wrath, the earth will tremble, and the nations will not be able to endure His indignation. So he continues with the thought. He said, we shouldn't fear these false gods, these false deities. They're nothing. They can't even move from one end of the room to the other, let alone help you or hurt you if you obey or disobey them. But you, Lord, you have power. You can discipline us. You can make the earth tremble. But these idols, it's a futile doctrine. Who in the world? Why would anybody believe this? We know how they're made. A man makes them. The men shape the silver to go on them and the brass, and they craft it themselves with their own hands. These deities are made. You, on the other hand, you're not made by man, but you made man. So there's a contrast quite clearly between the pagan deities that were often worshipped and the true God of heaven. These pagan deities had skeletons in their closets. They can't speak. They can't move. They can't do good. They can't do evil. They're made by men rather than being the maker of men. That is quite a skeleton to release. All right? But now there are those today out there who say, but the God of heaven is no different. Maybe he doesn't suffer from the same skeletons, but there are some skeletons in his closet that they say are there. And I'd like to look at, again, just three of those with you tonight, just briefly, and then the lesson will be yours. The first alleged skeleton that God has in his closet is the skeleton of human suffering. If God is God, why is there suffering? Why does he allow people to suffer? Why do animals die? Why do people die? Why do people get sick? Why do people get hurt? Why do things cause us grief and pain? Seems like if God is a God of love, he would have stopped that. In fact, they'll argue this. Christians say God is all-knowing, and he's all-powerful, and he's all-good. And I would agree with that. I believe the Bible affirms all of those things. God is a good, benevolent God, and he knows all things, and he's all-powerful. I believe that. But they say he can't be. He cannot be all three. He might hit two out of the three, but he can't be all three, and here's why. Well, maybe he's all-knowing. He knows that suffering exists in the world, and maybe he's all-powerful too, and he has the power to do something about it. He knows people are suffering, and he can alleviate that power. He's strong enough to do it, but he just isn't all good. He's not good enough to do it. He goes ahead and lets people suffer. So, is that who God is? He's all-powerful, all-knowing, but he's not good enough to stop suffering? Or maybe he's all-knowing and all-good, but he's just not powerful enough to do anything about it. Well, that's a deficient God. That's not the God of the Bible we serve. Or maybe it's this. Maybe he's all-good and all-powerful, but he doesn't know that people are suffering. You see, they say the existence of suffering eliminates the possibility of God, the God of the Bible, existing. Because there's suffering, you can't have a God who's all-knowing, all-powerful, and all-good. They say that's a skeleton in God's closet. They say we need to be illuminated to that because that God cannot exist possessing those three attributes. He might have two, but he can't have all three. But the God of the Bible declares all three. So what do we do with that? Well, the problem really is maybe twofold, and this is very fundamental, but the suffering that exists results from nature and from free will. And those things are not bad in and of themselves. You see, there's a presupposition that says that suffering's bad. And that's how their suffering's bad, therefore. But is it? Is suffering, human suffering, is that really an evil, morally evil thing? Suffering's a result of natural law. If I climbed up here on the top of this spire right here behind me, and I took a step out, or I stepped off a ladder, I'm going to get hurt. There will be suffering involved. Is that bad? Is gravity bad? Well, no, gravity's not bad. What would we do without gravity? How would we live without gravity? Gravity, a natural law, is a good thing. I'm glad God gave us gravity. But when I violate gravity, when I violate the laws of nature, then I suffer. But that's not a bad thing. It's just a violation of natural law that brings suffering. Is it a bad thing that wind blows? No. It moves the weather. It cycles the whole world with the rain and so forth. But wind can hurt people. Is it a bad thing that people breathe air? No, but that could get bad if you found yourself in the middle of the ocean without a boat, because you might drown. You see, on and on we can go with things that are just nature. When we violate nature, we get in trouble and we experience suffering. But that's not, nature isn't bad. Those things are good. And then there's suffering that's caused by free will. You know, I have the freedom to come up and punch you in the nose. You know, God gave us that freedom. I have the freedom to do good, to do evil. I have the freedom to get behind the wheel of a car and drive drunk or drive while I'm texting and hurt innocent people. Who's for removing free will? I don't know anybody that's willing to do that either. Free will's not a bad thing. But we suffer because of it. It's a good thing, but it brings suffering sometimes. Nature is a good thing. The laws of nature are good things that God gave us. But sometimes we suffer because of it. It's not evil that suffering exists, if that makes sense. In fact, there are remedial things about suffering that can actually, when we look at it from an eternal perspective, we can say, you know, it was good. Do you remember what David said in Psalm 119 and verse 71? It was good for me that I was afflicted. Wait, affliction? Good? Yeah. David said it taught me to obey and to learn the statutes of God. What would it be like if we had no suffering? If we had heaven on earth, would we ever lift our eyes to heaven? Would we ever long to be with the Lord? You see, there are things about suffering that draw us closer to God and that draw us closer to the purpose for which we have been created. I'm not saying suffering's pleasant, but I am saying that there are useful purposes as well for suffering. So human suffering is not just an automatic, look at this. There can't be a God because suffering exists. Well, that's not a strike against God. Look at a second thing. Foreknowledge. Wait, that's the skeleton in God's closet. Foreknowledge. You mean to tell me, wait, you say that God knew that man would sin before he even created man? Yeah. Revelation 13 and verse 8, Jesus was a lamb slain from the foundation of the world. God knew that man would sin and that sin would separate him from God, and that there would have to be some way to reconcile man to God. And God, before he even created the world, decided that his son Jesus would come and die as a lamb slain from the foundation of the world to die for our sins so that we could be reconciled. God knew in advance to creating the world that man would make a mistake and man would sin. But here's the argument. Well, if God knew that, how can he be a good God? How can he even exist, this God of the Bible, this good God of the Bible? A good God would never have gone forward with his plans. A good God looking forward and being able to see what would happen and see the choices that people made and how disobedient, rebellious they would become, a good God would have stopped it before it ever started. What kind of a God would allow that to happen? Again, that's really not a knock against God. Number one, foreknowledge doesn't mean that he causes the thing to happen. It's still our choice. The fact that he knows what's going to happen doesn't mean he caused it to happen. So, you know, there's responsibility on us as humans for that. But is it evil for God to have known that his creation would become sinful and that some would turn their back on him? Well, what if we put it in these terms? Man and a woman, they get married, and 5 years into their marriage, they decide, you know, we ought to have children. Wouldn't it be nice to have a child? Wouldn't it be nice to enjoy a child and to share our love with them and to help to mold them into citizens and to share our love back and forth, to love and to be loved, and let's have a child. Let's plan for that. And so this couple plans for that child, and they have a child, and they're so proud when that baby's born, and they're take it to church, or they take it down to the grocery mart, the market, you know, and they go in and they say, look at our baby. This is wonderful, isn't it? And somebody says, how in the world could you have children? You guys are evil. Do you not know before you have a child that that child will disappoint you? Well, yeah. Didn't you know that that child will someday disobey you? Well, yeah. Then how can you go ahead and bring him into the world when you know up front that he won't always do what he's supposed to do and that he'll do wrong things and he'll be hurt by his wrong choices? How can you be a good person? You guys are evil, wicked. Well, we don't charge people that want to have children with being wicked, do we? They know in advance, before they ever have children, that those children will sometimes be disobedient and rebellious and will even be hurt by their rebellion and disobedience. We know that up front. And we still proceed and have children and have families. And I don't know of anyone that says that's wicked. I don't know of anyone that says it to people, but they want to turn around and say to God, when he does the same thing, that he's wicked for it. There's nothing wicked for a mother or a man and a wife, husband and wife, to want to have somebody to share their love with and to love and to be loved in return. There's nothing wicked about that. And they may even know that there will be ups and downs in that relationship and the potential for that child to be hurt by rebellion and disobedience. They know that up front, but we still don't say that's wicked, because that desire to love and to be loved trumps the other. Well, if we can understand that with moms and dads, then why can't we understand that with God? There's nothing wicked about God wanting the best, to share in a communion and a relationship with us, to love and to be loved, knowing that some will become rebellious and even be hurt by their rejection of him and by their disobedience. But that's not a problem with God. That's not a skeleton in God's closet. Even one of the poets said, isn't it better to have loved and lost than to not love at all? We understand that principle. And so I don't think that that's a genuine problem with the existence of God. It's not a skeleton in his closet. And then here's the third one and the final one that we'll talk about tonight, just for your consideration. Sometimes people say, well, here's the kicker, hell. That's a skeleton in God's closet. How can a loving God, how can there be a hell? Come on, I mean, it's forever. You're going to tell me that because a person commits some offenses in this life for a finite period of time, that they are therefore now worthy of an infinite, eternal punishment? How can that be fair? You see, there can't be a God, a loving God, and have the existence of hell. It's just not right. I mean, I sin for just, you know, 10 minutes, decide to turn my back on God and live in rebellion to him, and I do it for 10 minutes and I'm struck dead by some accident, and now I got to suffer forever. I'm punished forever. That's not fair. Well, here are a couple thoughts. Number one, justice isn't measured in that way, is it? How long does it take to pull a trigger? Not very long. Is that what we do? We compare the length of time that it takes to commit a crime and we punish them according to the length of time it took to commit it? Well, no. That's not just. That's not how we base justice. So the fact that a person may sin for 2 years out of 90 years doesn't negate being punished the way God sees fit and worthy to be punished. That doesn't follow. And it really, if you talk to people about this, they have trouble with hell, but what if we just flip it and talk about the reward side of it? Is it right? Is it okay to reward a person eternally for a finite period of time in praising and worshiping and having faith in God? Well, yeah. You know, that's all right. I'm okay with that. I spend, you know, X amount of time in my life praising God, living by faith, and because of that finite thing, I get to spend time with him forever. I like that. That's good. Well, don't you see the inconsistency there? That's just, again, that's not how we measure judgment. In fact, I would say this, rather than being a skeleton in God's closet, I think hell is a necessity in the existence of the God of the Bible. How can the God of the Bible be a just God and there be no retribution, there be no accountability, there be no punishment for sin? I don't know how that can happen. I mean, what would you think if, you know, we're going to go down to the Knox County court system here and somebody has murdered somebody in your family. Somebody has committed some grievous offense against you and that person stands before the judge and the judge says, yeah, you know, I knew his daddy and, you're free. What? He's free? You can't set him free. That's not justice. We would throw a fit if that's the kind of justice that was meted out. That's not justice at all. There are crimes that are committed, and those crimes demand punishment. And that's true in a much broader scale, in a much higher court as well. God can't be God and not punish sin. And for God to just say, you know, I like y'all. You didn't do what I told you to do, and actually you raised a fist at me, but I like you. Okay, I'll let you in. That's not just. justice demands that there be an accountability and a reckoning for the things done in the Bible. So those are the three things that I just wanted to share with you tonight. As we talk about God and as we deal with God with people, not always does everybody come from the same background that we have, and they don't start with the same presuppositions that we start with. We believe that the God of the Bible is holy and just and right and good. And some say, no, no, you guys, you believe in a God that is you can't defend him. He can't exist. There are too many skeletons in his closet. He's not the God that you think he is. There's human suffering. There's this problem of his foreknowledge and proceeding with the creation. And there's this place called hell. That can't be. Well, hopefully tonight we've given some thoughts along those lines to at least spur your study. It's not exhaustive. It's surface material, but it does give you, I think, a way to address and begin to look at these questions a little bit further. The God of the Bible, he has no skeletons in his closet. The pagan deities do. There are tangible things that make us, that keep us from following them. Why would we follow a deity that can't even speak, that can't even move himself across the room, that can't even stand up without having somebody build a base so he won't topple over? That's a problem. But that's not the God of the Bible. The God of the Bible is powerful. He's the creator of us all. And he doesn't need men's help, but rather he is there to help us. If you're here tonight and you're not yet a child of God, a follower of this God who loves us, why don't you make that decision tonight? If you've not been baptized into Christ, do that tonight. And if you have already, but you're not living the kind of life you should live and you want to make changes, we'll pray with you if you want to make that change, if you'll come as we stand together and sing.